You're listening to the Bethel Community Church Podcast. Our podcast normally showcases our weekly sermons here in Chicago at 7601 West Foster. Now, podcasts are great, but they do not replace the care and community you receive from the local church or from your local pastor. So we encourage you to come, join our community, or contact us to help you find a community in your area. We pray the Lord speaks to you as you listen. Enjoy.
Bethel, how you doing today? Good? Okay. All right. Hey, last week we started a series that we titled In Sin and Air Pining. It was so beautiful to just sing that song right now in the glory, the beauty, all of it, and every verse as we sing that out, just great. And our hope is that over the next couple of weeks, we want to cultivate a longing for the coming arrival of Jesus that we celebrate on Christmas Day. So we're going to be stepping into the Old Testament to see their waiting, to see their desperation, and to see their need for Jesus. Last week we started with creation, and we saw all that they had, all that they were given in regards to their status with God, their relationship with God, with knowing God, being in His presence, and they lost all of it because of sin. Last week, sin never leads to satisfaction. It actually leads to pining, to the longing to return to what they had in the garden before, a deep longing to be back. We concluded last week with the Advent theme of hope. And what we said was their pining is not done absent of hope. Their longing is done with hope, because the narrative last week where we ended was with covenant, and God giving covenant, this promise to His people that He had set them aside and was going to bless them and bring them to a land, covenant that would eventually lead to the arrival of Jesus. So they're pining, they're waiting, they're longing, but they do so with hope. They're not abandoned. We know that God will bless them. They know that God will bless them. They know that while their relationship with God is different, not what they had in the garden, as we saw last week, they know that He has not left them. Pick up the narrative today. We're going to see something become clear about their time of waiting. We're going to see really what defines and marks their time of waiting and pining for return as they wait for Jesus in the fullness of this covenant to come out. What we're going to see today, that their sin is repetitive. They do the same things over and over and over, generation after generation. They repeat cycles of sin. It's like a loading icon, just spinning over and over and over, circling, going back to where it started, retracing its steps, and all the while it spins. You wait for the image to load. You wait for the advent. You wait for the arrival. You wait for Jesus. Their waiting is defined by cycles of sin. Today we're going to see that come into full view as we look at the nation of Israel, decision after decision, generation after generation, pining for a return, but they choose to retrace their own steps. Today, as we see that, we are going to ask ourselves if our lives are also marked by spinning, cycles of sin, repetition that we saw the nation Israel do. And so we pick right back up today in Genesis 15. Don't turn there, because I'm just going to give a little bit of an overview before we get to where we're really going to camp out today. Genesis 15, we see God fulfill His covenant promise. A miracle child, Isaac, is born. This is a really big deal because this was part of the promise that God gave to Abraham. So the narrative follows this family, Abraham's family and Isaac, through the ups and downs all the while. Here's what you need to know. God remains faithful through all of that, through all of their ups and downs. He's faithful in providing for them. the seed, the offspring of Abraham's family, is miraculously preserved through some really uncertain times like a famine. And it's really wild to read about how he saves them through his son, through Joseph, and in all the ways that God provides for this family and saves them from the family. Well, then they're hanging out in Egypt for a while, and their prominence soon turns into a threat, and they're put into slavery. For 400 years, the family of God was oppressed in slavery. Now, it'd be easy there to say, yeah, Mark, what about that hope? What about that now? It'd be easy to stop there and wonder what God was doing. Had he forgotten them? Wonder if it was time for the people of God to lose hope in the covenant. God calls Moses, right? He calls Moses to lead his people out of Israel. And it's pretty miraculous how that happens as well, right? Plagues, splitting of the sea. God saves the nation of Israel. And all of that has to do with his covenant and who he is. They're brought out of slavery. They're brought to the wilderness, to Mount Sinai. And it's there that God gives his people these important words. Check out the screen. Exodus 19, verses 5 and 6 says this. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples. For all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. That's what we get from that. God has not left his people. Now, here's the thing. What he's offering them in this relationship, hear me very clearly. This is not the garden. It's not the same. It's not that good. But God is opening a way for them to still have relationship. And what are they supposed to do? This is really important. They're supposed to listen to his voice and keep his commandments. And he says, when they do that, they will be his kingdom, which puts God as their king, God as their rule, God as their protector, God over them, and them, the nation, faithfully following his words. So God gives Moses the law. And it probably shouldn't surprise you that he gets the law up on Mount Sinai, and he comes down, and what does he see? They've already started worshiping the golden calf. They've already strayed from the very thing that God told them to do. So God punishes them, and God continues to be faithful. Amidst the sin and the rebellion and the grumbling and the sin, and even the sin of their leader Moses, God still brings them, the nation of Israel, to the promised land. Covenant. See, they're still cycling. They're still in their sin as they're pining and waiting, but God is still faithful. They get to the promised land, and it's not the garden. But it's their land. It's the land that he promised to Abraham, a land for them not to be in slavery, for God to be their king, for them to be God's treasured possession, for them to listen to the voice of God and follow his commands. Relationship. Joshua, the one that God has chosen to lead them into the promised land, they go through all these conquests to get it, but he dies, and something really important happens in Judges 1. They seek God, the nation seeks God to see, well, how are we going to have victory over the Canaanites? Who will fight for them? That's their question. So the Lord gives them specific instruction that they choose not to follow. They choose not to follow God's voice. Should be familiar of some of what we saw in Exodus, in the cycling there. They reject the commandment of God. Sin still reigns. They are in sin, in error, pining over and over. And then we get to Judges 2. Look at what God says to Judges 2. Check out the screen here. It says this. I think that's the wrong verses there, but that's on me. I think I sent them the wrong ones. You can just hear what I said. Here, Judges 2, 1 through 4. I brought you up from Egypt and brought you into the land that I swore to give to your fathers. I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall break down their altars, but you have not obeyed my voice. What is this that you have done? So now I say, I will not drive them out before you, but they shall become thorns in your side, and their gods shall be a snare to you. As soon as the angel of the Lord spoke these words to all the people of Israel, the people lifted up their voices and they wept. What's happening here? God points out, I kept my promise, but you didn't listen to my voice. I told you what to do, and you didn't obey my commands. Not obeyed my voice. It goes back to Exodus 19 of the very thing that he told them to do. For all of this, they're still trying to do it on their own. They're still cycling. They're still spinning around in their own sin. And their response to that is weeping. Long lay the world in sin and error. This is not better. See still how far they've come from the garden. Do you see how removed this is, how different it is? And we get to Judges 2:11. It says, the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and they served Baals, and they abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of Egypt. Do you hear that? They abandon God and they start serving Baals and other gods. Anytime we abandon God's voice and reject God's voice and choose not to listen to what God has said, what we do is we replace him with an idol. We replace him with another god in his place. What Israel is doing here. So Israel marches out for battle. It says that the hand of the Lord was against them. Why? Because they didn't listen to his voice and they did the very thing that they should not have. They're losing their land to this other nation. Should remind us a little bit of them losing the garden. And now the armies are coming in and destroying them. And it says in verse 15 that they were in terrible distress. So it's time for a status check again with Israel. Hey, Israel, how's it going? Is the sin satisfying you? Is the pining and the longing to return, how is that going for something better? But God remains faithful to his covenant. He continues to rescue his people. Judges 2 closes with the raising up of judges to save the people. In the rest of the book of Judges, if you were to just like summarize the whole book of Judges, what people would say is just cycles of sin. Over and over, it's and they did what was right in their own eyes. And then you see the devastation that it leads to, and them losing their land to all these other people. And then they're like, hey, wait a minute, this isn't better. We actually really don't like this. And they cry out to God again, who hears them again and remains merciful and faithful to them over and over. And you read the book and you're like, oh my goodness. We just keep doing the same thing, don't we? We just see within our sin that we just keep repeating. We just keep rejecting the voice of God. We keep doing exactly the opposite of what he says in Exodus 19 to do. And we arrive through all the ups and downs of different judges. We come to this judge, Samuel. God raises up Samuel. Samuel calls the people to return to God, just like so many judges had done before him. He calls them to put away their idols in 1 Samuel 7, and then we arrive in 1 Samuel 8. And it's a pivotal moment in Israel's history, and it's where we're going to dig into today as we continue to cultivate a hunger and deep desire for the arrival of Jesus. So turn in your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 8. I hope all that background is helpful. I think it will be, because as you see what happens today in the text, it's just going to light up to you and be like, wow, deja vu. We've been here. They've been warned about this. They should have known. And when we put all of that together, it's going to help us arrive where we need to arrive at the end. So we're going to be starting in verse 1 and reading the first 5 verses here to start. You guys ready? That was not very promising. You guys ready? Okay, good. Let's do this. I'm excited about this. I love this passage. Lots of good things for us to see here. It says this, "Now when Samuel became old, he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second, Abijah. And they were judges in Beersheba. Yet his sons did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after gain. They took bribes and perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together, and they came to Samuel at Ramah. And they said to him, 'Behold, you who are old and your sons do not, you are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint for us a king to judge us like the other nations.'" Stop there for a second. Samuel appoints his sons as judges. They're not doing such a good job. Doesn't help that they're evil, okay? Evil judges. Not a good situation when the judges are supposed to be pointing them back to who God is. So the elders sit down and they're like, "Hey, what's next? We should start thinking about that." And their idea is, let's put in a king. Now, this feels off a little bit, and it's different from anything that has happened in all of the book of the Judges as we've looked at these cycles of sins and this whole narrative. This jumps off this page is different. This hasn't happened before, and it should feel a little bit uncomfortable for two reasons. First reason it should feel uncomfortable is because God is their king. So when they say, "Give us a king," it should feel off to us because what they're saying is we want to replace God. Think about this, okay? A king provides safety and protection. Who's done that for Israel this whole time? Come on now. Yeah, that's right. God has done it, okay? Slavery, famine, neighboring armies, conquest after conquest, the wilderness. Come on. Over and over, God has been their protection. He's been their king, right? A king rules and reigns with authority, right? Who's been their authority? Same one in Exodus 19 that says, "Hey, obey my commands." He already set out the law. He already set out what they're supposed to do. He's already set up the covenant. "You shall obey my commands." There's already a king in town. That's God. He already set out his rule and reign. A king is one who speaks and everyone listens. Remember Exodus 19, you're supposed to listen to my voice. You will be my people. So the first thing is that it should feel off is, hey, this is, they already have a king, and it's God. But the second reason, they say like that they want to be like every other nation. That should feel totally off, too. Because you know why? They're not like every other nation. They're God's treasured possession. Exodus 19, they're the kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Holy, set apart, other, different. They're not supposed to represent anything like the other nations because of who God is and who God has made them and what God has brought them into within relationship and covenant with him. No one else has that. When they say they want to be like the other nations, it's like, hold up, why? Look at what you have. So hear me on this. To request a king in this verse is to reject God's kingship. It's to reject their identity of being God's people. That's what's happening here. They say they want to look like the other nations. Verse 20 in this passage speaks a little bit more to what they mean when they say they want to look like the other nations. Verse 20 says, "That we may be like the other nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles." I legitimately start to laugh at that. Because every time that they've tried to go into battle by themselves, it's been a really bad performance. The one who's always gone out before them and with them has been God and brought them victory. They think that being like the other nations and having a king over them will be to their benefit, that it'll be to their help. That if they could just have someone, if they could just have a person to be their one protector and provider, then everything would go well. They want this king, and they think that this king will bring peace. Oftentimes, Old Testament idea and thought of peace would be absent of war. And they think, hey, fight our battles, there's going to be peace. There'll be absence of war. This is going to be so good. They think, yeah, we can replace God. And you know what we're going to find? We're going to find peace. Samuel also thinks that the request is off. So he goes to God with it. Check out this exchange starting in verse 6. This thing displeased Samuel that they said, give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, obey the voice of in all that they say to you. For they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. According to all the deeds that they have done, from the day I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so also they are doing to you. Now then, obey their voice. Only you shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them. Obey their voice. Twice. God says it twice, and it's so intentional. Why? They were supposed to be following the voice of God, the commands of God, and here they are. God says, obey their voice. That is a clear signal to the reader, to all of us, and to them. What's happening here? It goes back to Judges 2. God said that their fault was that they did not listen to God's voice. Listening to God's voice keeps us from sin. Choosing to abandon his voice always leads to sin. It always leads to cycles. It leads to spiraling. And it leads to this repetition for Israel. Devastating. And it should give us flashbacks to the garden where they didn't listen to God's instruction there as well. It should feel familiar to all of their rebellion throughout the Old Testament up until this point. And it's here that God says, let them have it. Scary. Pair that with God's words to Samuel when he says, Samuel, they're not rejecting you. They're rejected. I've watched this be loaded for all of these generations. I've watched them load this same thing over and over and cycle this. Israel's been sinful. They've done what's right in their own eyes. They've rebelled. They've sinned. They've worshipped calves, golden calves and Baals, rampant with sin, choosing to replace God, waiting, longing, hoping. Samuel warns them, just like God asked them to, in verses 10 through 18. I'm not going to read them today for the sake of time, but I mean, honestly, it's just, here's the cliff notes of it. He says, this is going to change everything. This king is going to rule over you in a way that you are going to lose everything. Your offspring will be his. He will plow your land. Your peace will be turned to war. Interesting. He will take the best of your wine and olive oil. He will take your servants. He will take your animals, specifically mentions donkeys, which I think is interesting. He says, you will be his slaves. And it closes by saying this. And in that day, there will be a day that you cry out to God. I mean, there's no way they make this trade, right? You're looking at it on paper. And there's no way they trade God, right, as their king, for all that they're going to lose, not only with God not being their king, but all the things that they're going to have to give up, their offspring and their land and all of their animals. There's no way that they would choose that, right? But, like they traded life in the garden for a bite of fruit. Trade being God's treasured possession for a human king. It makes no sense, but sin will do that. Where you choose something that makes no sense, The trade is not ever worth it, but you're willing to make it because you've thought that it's better, or you've been deceived into thinking it's better. Verse 19 says they refused to listen to the voice of Samuel. Key in on that, because what they're refusing is to listen to the voice of God who is speaking through the judge Samuel. Not God's, Samuel's voice, and they're rejecting it in that moment. Verse 19, their response is, they say, no, there should be a king over us. So Samuel repeats to the Lord what the people have said. Look at verse 22 with me. This is really important. Verse 22. Samuel comes back and hears the words of the people and he repeats them to the Lord. Verse 22, it says, and the Lord said to Samuel, obey their voice and make them a king. Obey their voice and make them a king. Isn't that wild? To see them just blatantly rejecting God like this. The one who created them. The one who gave them purpose. The one who knew them and that relationship was without fear or shame. And here they are saying no. Fast forward a couple of chapters. This king, his name is Saul, and they're putting him in as king. And even there, God sets out another warning and clearly explains what they are choosing as a nation. We're going to have the verses up on the screen here. 1 Samuel 10, verses 18 and 19, it says, and thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, I brought up Israel out of Egypt, and I delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians. And from the hand of all the kingdoms that were oppressing you, but today you have rejected your God who saves you out of all calamities and in your distresses. And you have said to him, set a king over us. They have strayed, my friends, so far from the garden that on this day they believe they're better off without God. They believe that they can bring on their own peace, that they can look at every other nation and be like them and be led by a human and that it would be better. I think it's interesting they couldn't become like God in the garden or at the tower, but now they've strayed so far from what they had before, and their sin has spiraled and cycled to such a devastating point. They're not just trying to become like God. They're saying, we have a new God. Rejection of the covenant. It's a rejection of the garden. It's a rejection of God. It's a rejection of the Creator. It's a rejection of their literal created self in the image of God. Replacing God is devastating on every level. So it happens. Saul is set as a king over them. In 1 Samuel 10:24, the people shout this, long live the king. I think that replacing God is at an all-time low with those four words. Why do I say that? Because in that moment, they're giving their praise and even their worship and even their trust into this king. Do you see that? Long live this king. Hail this king. Their adoration and praise is fixed on a human. More than veered off track from the covenant with God, they've pushed it aside entirely. They've replaced him in sin and error pining. Is it better? How's it going, Israel? Is this going to provide the peace that they said it would? The power that they hoped that it would? Will this satisfy the jealous longings of their heart? Will this idol prove to be worthy? For that, I want to jump two chapters ahead to Samuel giving his farewell speech. He's been grieved with Israel's decision, and it's in 1 Samuel 12, verse 14, that we get this. It's up on the screen. It says this, if you will fear the Lord and serve him and obey his voice and not rebel against the commandment of the Lord, and if both you and the king who reigns over you will follow the Lord your God, it will be well. What he's saying is just follow God's voice. Even now, even as you take this king, even as you veer off from covenant and replace God, just even now, if you and your king would just listen to the voice of God and follow the commands of your God, if you would satisfaction there. It will be well for you. There will be peace there. It will be good for you. So what happens? Saul disobeys God. He didn't listen to God's very specific instructions about how they were to go into battle and what they were supposed to do. He doesn't stay within the commands of what God says. So you know what? It will not be well for them. God rejects Saul. And in a hauntingly familiar verse, 1 Samuel 15:10, and it's the final verse that we're going to look at today. Look at how hauntingly familiar this is to what we saw last week in Genesis. 1 Samuel 15:10 says, "The word of the Lord came to Samuel. I regret that I made Saul king, for he has turned his back from following me and has not performed my commandments." Regret, it sounds familiar, right? This is Genesis 6. He said he was sorry that he made humanity and the animals. Sin grieves God. But here's where I'm at right now. How can we be back here again with grieving God in this way? Like, how could we choose this again? How could we pick anything other than the garden? How could we pick anything other than knowing God? How could we choose the very thing that leads to destruction again? They know their history. They've seen their history. They continue to choose to stray from the commands of God over and over and over. They're pining, they're longing for a return, but they're choosing. Waiting is marked by cycles. It's like a loading icon, waiting for the right thing to load, yet they continue and choose to go for one more circle around. Hoping and longing and waiting for the right thing to finally come. It's maddening, isn't it? Who's this annoying? All my tech people out here. Yeah. I hope you feel that today. I want you to feel the desperation for this circle and this loading to stop. Truth to your man, I can't even take it like 7 seconds when I'm waiting for something to load on my computer, right? I'm like, oh, the internet's bad here. Check my Wi-Fi. Close out the app. Try it again. You know what I'm saying? Like 7 seconds. Y'all are going on like 30 minutes with this here. Exactly. Israel waited. For thousands of years, they cycle and continue their sin. And we do that. We allow sin to cycle. As individuals, as a nation, as a church, we should choose to learn from the pining of Israel, not revisit the sins of our past. We should learn from the pining of Israel that we won't ever get away with it, that it always leads to destruction. We should learn from the pining of Israel that God deals with it every time. We should learn from Israel that the cycle is painful. It's marked with disappointment. It's marked with loss. We should learn from the pining of Israel that it lacks peace. It lacks satisfaction. And it creates a real longing for peace. What cycles of sin do you find yourself revisiting? Within your personal life, within your family, in your church, within your heart. How did they get there? How did that happen? How was it that you could look at, how is it that I could or we could ever look at what we trade? Because that's not a fair trade. It's never a good trade. But how do we get to that point? Just like Israel's waiting is marked by cycles, their cycles are marked by something too. The reason for it is because they reject God's voice. If their waiting is marked by cycles, then we need to know that their cycles are marked by replacing God's voice, straying from his commands, which is idolatry. When we exchange God's voice and we're putting something else in there, it's an idol. For Israel in 1 Samuel 8, it's a king where they put their hope for peace. They thought that a king would break them from their cycles and give them what they were pining for and longing for. this will be the return that we had hoped for. That's what they thought. That's an idol. Author and theologian Jackie Hill Perry says this about idolatry. Idolatry always involves an exchange. It's a magician's act in which the holy is traded for the profane, the unique for the common, the transcendent for the earthly, the creator for the creature. We take what God has called good and we remove a letter. We do that. On the regular, we do that. What have we exchanged the words of God for? What is it that is created that we have put higher than the creator? What are you looking to right now to provide peace, to provide comfort, to provide the very things that God said to you that he would provide within himself? What have you given to a created thing that should only be in the place in your heart for God? What is it this Christmas season that you're truly longing for the arrival of? Is it the person and the work of Jesus? Or is it satisfaction in other people, in other things, in other events, in other traditions that are all straying you away from what we are truly longing for, who Jesus is? Who or what is it that you look to give any sort of sign that you are back in the garden? What has dropped 1-0 from being good to being God? I'll say something positive. Here's one thing that Israel kind of had the right idea about. They were right that a ruler would bring them peace. But they missed who the ruler was because they exchanged God's voice. Because they forgot or rejected covenant. And God's covenant and his promise was to bring them blessing. A covenant to bring them salvation and a Messiah. God's covenant and hope is still very much alive and active as we close out today in 1 Samuel. But we see that this covenant of hope is also one of peace, because the arrival that they're waiting for and the cycling of sin of a nation that is described and desperate in 1 Samuel is actually described in the verses that they read this morning about advent of peace. Isaiah 9, 6 and 7. Listen to it again now through the framework of everything that we've heard and what Israel is spinning and pining over. Listen to it again. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder. And his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. The increase of his government and peace, there will be no end on the throne of David and over his kingdom to establish it and uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. There will be a king that brings peace. It wasn't Saul or David. It was a descendant of David. There would be a ruler who would bring peace, peace that has no end, not the one that is a lack of war, but it's a different peace of shalom, of fullness. They're longing for peace, and repeated efforts to bring that about themselves could only be met through Jesus, the one who would take the punishment for their cycles of sin, to bring about the truth and the reality of Romans 5 that we also read today. Hear that again. Therefore, we have been justified by faith. We have what? With God through our Lord Jesus Christ. God is faithful. And they're waiting. And they're longing. God is going to bring the image to load. Jesus. And all the peace that he provides. And today I'm going to call the elders forward. We're going to come to our communion table right now, which this is so cool because in our time of waiting in Advent, as we think about the coming of Jesus, what's awesome is that he has come and that we get to live in the reality of this peace even now today. We talked about communion last month as something of a celebration and communal that we all do together. So today, as we receive communion, we remind ourselves that in our waiting, he's good and he's already brought this about. Peace has come, the image has loaded, and it's Jesus. God, I thank you so much for the truth of your son Jesus in the longing, in the waiting, and the truth that we know and we think about here today. Pray these things in Jesus' name.